Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Susan Shand, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
The leaders of North and South Korea say they have agreed to turn the Korean Peninsula into a land of peace without nuclear weapons and nuclear threats. The agreement was announced Wednesday, on the second day of talks between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. They spoke to reporters after meeting in Pyongyang. At the meeting, North Korea announced plans to invite international observers to watch the closing of its missile testing center and launch area at Dongchang-ri. North Korea also offered to close its main nuclear center at Yongbyon, but on one condition. In exchange, the North said it was seeking corresponding measures from the United States. It is not yet clear what those measures would be. South Korean President Moon traveled to the North Korean capital on Tuesday for his third meeting this year with the North Korean leader. Moon is seeking to break an impasse in negotiations to end the North's nuclear weapons program. The two leaders signed a joint statement on Wednesday. In addition, military representatives signed a document stating steps to ease military tensions between North and South. That document called for, among other things, setting up buffer zones in places where the two militaries could come into conflict. Also, Kim Jong-un said he would visit Seoul in the near future. Moon said the visit is expected to take place before the end of 2018. In Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump expressed approval of the latest developments, calling them very exciting on Twitter. North and South Korea have announced a number of joint economic projects, including plans to build roads and railways. However, some Korea watchers believe that some of the new agreements could violate United Nations sanctions on North Korea. Days before the meeting in Pyongyang, the U.S. government ordered sanctions to punish a company based in China, its top official, and a company linked to Russia. The goal of the economic restrictions is to force the North Korean government to negotiate an end to its nuclear weapons and missile programs. The U.S. and Japan say those programs are a direct threat to them. Members of the U.S. Congress and some experts say there has been no clear sign that North Korea plans to denuclearize. Harry Kazianis is an expert in defense studies at the Center for National Interest in Washington, D.C. He said the sanctions remain in place and are a major issue. But first, Kim needs to make major progress toward denuclearization, he said. President Moon will travel to New York next week for the United Nations General Assembly. Moon said he looked forward to North Korea and the United States resuming their dialogue. He is expected to meet with President Trump on September 24th. Moon added that South Korea would continue its part in supporting talks between the U.S. and North Korea. The aim, he said, is that the sides will hold another summit as soon as possible and find a middle ground to reach an agreement. Also on Wednesday, the two Koreas announced that they would seek to jointly hold the 2032 Summer Olympic Games. They also said they would work closely together in preparation for the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. I'm Mario Ritter.
Government has approved a measure to help enforce a top court decision on a centuries-old Muslim custom. The approval came after the government failed to get Parliament to act on the decision. A year ago, the High Court ruled against the custom of triple talaq. The court found that it was unlawful for Muslim men to end a marriage by simply saying a single word three times. It ruled this violated the constitutional rights of Muslim women. Many of India's 170 million Muslims follow the Muslim personal law for family disputes. The laws include giving men permission to end their marriages by saying the Arabic word for divorce, talaq, three times. The word can be said any time and anywhere, even as part of a telephone call or text message. The government will have another 6 months to get Parliament's approval for the new ordinance to become law. For now, Indian officials can use the measure to take legal action against suspects. Law Minister Ravi Shankar Prasad said that nearly 22 countries, including Pakistan and Bangladesh, have banned the custom. He appealed to the opposition to approve the Muslim Women Protection of Rights on Marriage Bill. India's Muslim Law Board had told the court that they did not like the custom, but it opposed any court interference in religious issues. The board's members asked that the subject of triple talaq be left to the Muslim community. But several Muslim activists condemned the position of the law board. After the Supreme Court decision, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government proposed a bill that would criminalize the custom. The bill was approved in December by the lower house of parliament, where Modi's party has a majority. But it has yet to be approved by the upper house, where the opposition has the majority. The main opposition Congress party is opposing the bill because of the 3-year prison sentence for the offenders. It wants a less severe sentence. It also wants a parliamentary committee to discuss the issue to find a compromise. In India, triple talaq has continued because of laws that give Muslims, Christians, and Hindus permission to follow religious laws in marriage and other family issues. While most Hindu personal laws have been changed over the years, Muslim laws have been left to religious leaders and are rarely changed. I'm Susan Shand.
Graduating from high school, many young people are excited to go off to college. But not all. Some may want to skip college and jump right into a business. That was the case with John Cronin from Long Island, New York. He did not dream of going to college. He dreamed of going into business with his father. But they did not know what kind of business. John Cronin told Money Magazine that he thought about starting a food truck. But there was one problem. Neither he nor his father can cook. After some thinking, the father-son team decided to go into business making a product the younger Cronin loves: socks. Mark, John's father, says his son has always loved colorful, wild socks. So they created John's Crazy Socks Company. The younger Cronin explains what he loves about his work.
I would sell crazy socks. Why socks? Because it's fun, it's colorful, I like to be creative, and I want to do wonderful things here.
You're a talented guy.
Yes, I am.
John was born with Down syndrome, a genetic disorder that causes learning disabilities and developmental delays. But that has not stopped him from gaining major success in the business world. Since launching John's Crazy Socks, father and son have been crazy busy making crazy money. But their business also helps others with disabilities.
We've been able to create 35 jobs. 18 of those are held by people with differing abilities. We've raised over $135,000 for our charity partners.
The father and son divide the duties of the business. John works on sock design, but he is also the face of the company. This means he represents the company on its advertising used to help sell the product and on the packaging of the product. Mark takes care of the books, managing money, supplies, and hiring. John and Mark try to make each sock purchase personal. So they hand carry orders to customers in the Long Island area. But for those who live farther, John sends a personal note with each order he sends.
What's our mission?
Our mission is bring happiness.
Our customers are happy.
Right.
We have over 10,000 online reviews. 96% of those are 5-star reviews. And we've done a lot of work, a lot of business. We've shipped over 115,000 orders and earned over $4 million in revenue.
5% of John's profits goes to the Special Olympics. The company also gives to the National Down Syndrome Society and the Association for Children with Down Syndrome. John Cronin is living his dream, spreading happiness one pair of crazy socks at a time. I'm Ana Mateo.
The world's first hydrogen-powered trains have begun running in Germany. They began carrying passengers Monday in Germany's northern Lower Saxony state. The new trains will run 100-kilometer trips and can travel up to 140 kilometers an hour. A French railroad company called Alstom built the two trains. Teams in Germany and France cooperated on the project, which was supported by the German government. The new train model, called the Coradia Eilant, signals the beginning of efforts in Germany and other nations to move away from pollution-producing diesel trains. The Coradia Eilant is designed to run on non-electrified train lines with low levels of noise. It uses a process that combines hydrogen and oxygen to produce electrical power. If the system produces more energy than the train needs at that time, it can store the extra energy in batteries. The only emissions are water and steam. A single tank of hydrogen can run a Coradia Eilant train for about 1,000 kilometers. This is very similar to the distance a diesel-powered train can run on with a single tank. Hydrogen-powered trains cost more than diesel trains to build. But Alstom officials say the operating costs are much lower. The company plans to provide another 14 Coradia Eilant trains to Lower Saxony by 2021. The head of railroad operations in the area, Carmen Schwabel, praised replacing diesel trains with hydrogen. She said the move was an important first step in using clean-burning technologies to reach climate protection goals. Schwabel added, "We also do this because about 120 diesel train sets in our vehicle pool will reach the end of their lifetime within the next 30 years, meaning we will have to replace them. The experience gained with this project helps us find a sustainable and practical solution." Officials say the area's many wind turbines will produce part of the energy to create the hydrogen to power the trains. Alstom says several other European countries have also expressed interest in developing hydrogen train systems. France has already said it wants its first hydrogen train to be operating by 2022. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Washington. He was the first president of the United States. He served from 1789 to 1797. But he had many other accomplishments too. He owned thousands of hectares of land in his home state of Virginia. He was a famous general who led the American colonists to freedom from British rule, and he presided over the convention that created the U.S. Constitution. For Washington, that was enough. He said he wanted to retire from public service and return home. But the country's new electors had other ideas. They wanted him to move to New York and invent the American presidency. Washington accepted the job as his duty. Washington was sworn in as president in 1789. At the time, a truly United States was still just an idea. Americans were unconnected groups. They came from different countries, had different religions, and spoke different languages. For example, a quarter of the people in the state of Pennsylvania spoke only German. Doug Bradburn is the founding director of the Washington Library at Mount Vernon. He says, when Washington took office, the country was fragile.
The chances that it would even survive were probably very, very slim.
Bradburn explains that Washington had to establish social and political unity. But the Constitution did not say how the president could do that. So, Bradburn says, Washington invented the job for all future presidents. He established a group of advisors called the Cabinet, as well as the nation's official money. He appointed a 6-member Supreme Court, and he created the Department of Foreign Affairs, now called the State Department. However, Washington said it was the president's responsibility to set foreign policy. Historian Doug Bradburn explains that Washington established the president not just as a figurehead, but as a decision maker. But he always used the Constitution as his guide.
He wasn't just trying to establish an office and then figure out a way to justify it. He was trying to work with his Constitution.
George Washington was born in 1732 in the colony of Virginia. His father died when George was 11 years old. As a boy, he learned reading, writing, and math. Then he worked as a land surveyor in western Virginia. Historian Joseph Ellis points out that Washington did not have a formal education. Instead of going to college, Ellis says, Washington went to war. He fought against the French and Indians as a British army officer. That experience informed Washington's worldview. Ellis describes the first president as a realist. At the same time, Washington was a very passionate man with extremely strong emotions. He was known to get angry, but he showed his temper to only a few people. Washington not only acted like a great leader, he looked like one.
George Washington stood about 1.9 meters tall. That was a head taller than the average man of his time. He was very strong and very graceful. He was known as one of the best horseback riders and best dancers in Virginia. But he had a problem: bad teeth. Unlike his wife, Martha, who was known for her lovely smile, George Washington began losing his teeth in his 20s. When he was sworn in as president, he had only one tooth left. Washington remains an important figure in the American imagination. Even today, people tell stories about him. One popular story, that he had wooden teeth, is not true. But he did wear dentures. They were made, in part, from hippopotamus ivory. And he did not chop down a cherry tree as a child, and then admit it by saying, "I cannot tell a lie." In fact, historian Joseph Ellis says, Washington lied many times. But it is true that as Washington became more famous, his reputation grew. People thought of him as a man who always did the right thing. Joseph Ellis says even Washington understood people would look at his writings and judge him.
Washington went from being a man to a monument. He was aware of the fact that he had a role to play and that all emerging nations need mythical heroes.
Washington became very protective of his personal thoughts. His wife burned most of their letters. Yet, we know a little bit about Washington's thoughts from other writing. One of his regrets, he said, was that he had not done something to end slavery. Like many plantation owners, Washington was a slaveholder. More than 300 enslaved people lived on his property. By the end of his life, Washington opposed slavery. He left a will ordering his survivors to free his slaves after his wife's death. Washington's will became relevant sooner than he might have liked. 3 years after he finished his second term as president, Washington fell ill. He had been outside riding his horse on a cold, wet day. When he came home, he complained of a sore throat. Over the next 2 days, his condition became worse. On December 14th, 1799, he died in his bed, surrounded by his wife, enslaved maids, and friends. He was 67. Historian Joseph Ellis says one of the best things about George Washington was his ability to give up power. At the end of the Revolutionary War, General Washington surrendered his sword. And at the end of his administration, President Washington simply returned home.
You could trust Washington with power because he was so conspicuously willing to give it up.
Doug Bradburn says Washington was the right man at the right time. Bradburn, like many historians, calls George Washington the indispensable man. In other words, Washington was essential to the American experiment in self-government. He made ideas about American freedom real, and he showed that even the president would operate under the rule of law.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.